I'm Roger Silverstone. I'm Professor of Media and Communications here at the school. And it's my great pleasure and privilege to welcome my boss to give a lecture this evening. Howard Davis, whom I'm not going to introduce biographically, has recently completed a tour of duty on Terry Burns's committee reviewing the future of the BBC and advising the DCMS and Tessa Jowell on their views as to how that future could be planned and prepared for. They've been organizing over the last... Yes, they've been organized... Is that better? Do I have to repeat myself? No. Thank you. They've been organizing over the last few months, since early September, a series of seminars, public seminars, at which different aspects of the organization of the BBC have been considered. And they have very recently delivered a report to the Secretary of State. And of course, at this moment in time, this is a very particular moment in time, we are waiting the outcome, and we are waiting the fruits of the DCMS's own thinking on this in the form of a green paper, which I think was due to be published a week or so ago, but we are still, I understand, under consideration. So the green paper is due. The key agenda, I think, during the course of the deliberations and the discussions turned out to be not what some of us thought it might be the starting question, although it was a starting question, which is, what is the BBC for, and how is it going to change over the next 10 years? Nor was it actually contentiously, I think it would be fair to say, an issue of a funding, the license fee. Tessa Jowell had said quite some time ago that the license fee was reasonably secure. And by and large, as I understand it, that wasn't at the heart of the real gritty agenda. What was at the heart of the agenda came to be very quickly one that, in a sense, anyone who was watching the BBC since Hutton would recognize as being central, and that was the agenda of governance, and in particular, the role of the BBC governors in the future management and direction of the BBC. And the issue was one of accountability and responsibility to the various stakeholders in the BBC. And Howard Davis, I think, was absolutely central in requiring the committee to address this agenda and to address this agenda rigorously. And I think, and this is, I think, the core of what he's going to talk about this evening. It is a question of governance, and I think the bottom line question, I may not agree with me, is the question is of who governs the governors. And I'd like to welcome Howard Davis to talk about his views on the BBC now. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. I've noticed in this place that whenever a member of the academic staff refers to me as their boss, they do so with sort of heavy inverted commas. And certainly in any school committee, they don't behave as if that were the case. As Roger said, that's what I've been spending a bit of my time on recently, the Burns Committee. And as he rightly said, governance has been at the centre of our consideration. Though I will say a little bit about funding, because I think that still remains an issue. And the arguments about the future funding of the BBC are changing in interesting ways as a result of new technology. Now, the first BBC charter, the DCMS website will tell you if you consult it, ran from January 1927 to December 1936. And at that time, the BBC was cosily housed on Savoy Hill, just around the corner from here. You can still see a plaque on the wall of the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, I think it is, or Electrical Engineers. And the website also tells us that we are now approaching the end of the seventh charter. Now, I've had the opportunity of consulting our distinguished mathematicians here, who confirm my suspicion that there is something odd about this arithmetic. Somewhere along the way, a decade has been lost. But that is not, as we shall see, the only odd thing about the governance of the BBC. Now, the current charter comes to an end in December of next year. And one might therefore think that in 12 months' time it would be a good idea to begin thinking about it. Yet in fact the process has been underway for almost a year already. And the Burns panel on which I sat was appointed last spring. One BBC governor pointed out to me the other day that 30% of each charter period is spent reviewing it. which creates a difficult environment for the corporation's management. And I have some sympathy for that view. On the other hand, there seems to be no limit to the number of groups and individuals who wish to make their contribution to the process, so time is needed. Now, charter review is typically the occasion for some breastbeating about the future of broadcasting and the role of the BBC in our national life. The first charter was drafted following the report of the Sykes Committee, which initially recommended licence fee funding. And subsequent renewals have spawned a series of further reviews, the Crawford Committee, the Selsdon and Ulswater Committees in the 30s, the Hankey Committee, and indeed the Beveridge Committee in the 1940s, when the LSE first took a hand in the affairs of the BBC. Beveridge was happy to see the BBC remain as the sole broadcaster, though Selwyn Lloyd produced a dissenting minority report recommending the end of its monopoly. In more recent times, the story was taken up by the Pilkington Committee, which I had not recalled included both Richard Hoggart and Joyce Grenfell. The Annan Committee, the Hunt Committee, the Peacock Committee, Alan not Michael, and the Davis Committee, Gavin not Howard. These days, formal committees and royal commissions have rather gone out of fashion. This government typically prefers reviews by individuals, normally written by officials in the Treasury. Whether that produces an improvement in the quality of decision-making is a subject for another day. Now, on this occasion, the background to charter renewal has been somewhat complicated by the Hutton inquiry. Now, of course, Lord Hutton did not inquire directly into the governance and funding of the BBC, but his report cast some light on the complex relationship between the governors and the management of the corporation. And he concluded the governors should have recognised more fully than they did that their duty to protect the independence of the BBC was not incompatible with giving proper consideration to whether there was validity in the government's complaints. Now, this conclusion, and indeed many others in Lord Hutton's report, has been heavily contested by those involved. And as a result, I think its influence on the new charter will be quite small. Indeed, Hutton's conclusions on the role of the governors were barely mentioned in the debate in public stimulated by the Burns panel, and the Burns panel recommendations owe little or nothing to them. The medium-term consequences of the Hutton report have been somewhat different from those which its author appears to have intended. In his recent book, Brown's Britain, Robert Peston neatly summarises the reaction in the heart of government. Blair's immediate reaction, he says, was relief that the government was cleared of acting disreputably, but his elation soon turned to despair. Hutton's report had been so forgiving of the government that it was widely derided as incredible. Far from restoring the Prime Minister's reputation, voters' confidence in the stewardship of the country fell even further. The Prime Minister, of course, has recently apologised for all of this, which makes us all feel a lot better about it. The point about Hutton in relation to the Charter, as I see it, is that it creates an environment in which any steps taken by the government to alter the governance of the corporation risk being seen as an act of revenge, or at least of cutting the BBC down to size. Far from making it easier to envisage a different regulatory regime for the corporation, or even changes in the role and composition of the governors, Hutton has made it more difficult. For those who believe, like I do, that it's important to create a more rational framework to guard the BBC's independence, that is yet another unfortunate outcome from that inquiry. Now, perhaps that's one reason why the government has chosen to take a slow and deliberate approach to the process of renewing the charter, beginning with a public consultation, then the reports by the Burns panel, and proceeding on through a green paper, presumably then a white paper, and conceivably a bill, before the eighth charter itself struggles into the world. As Private Eye used to say, this one will run and run. The panel process was quite interesting. It was chaired, as I've already mentioned, by Lord Terry Burns. I guess one could take that for granted these days, since he chairs most inquiries, from the Financial Services and Markets Act to the National Lottery, fox hunting, to the BBC, and now the Football Association. If only there were enough hours in Lord Burns's day to allow him to handle Ireland and the Middle East, the world would be a safer place. The other members of the panel were Alan Budd of Oxford, Sly Bailey of the Mirror Group, Tim Gardam, a former broadcaster, Janet Finch of Keele University, and Alistair Rawson of the Design Museum. My own role, I suppose, was to bring some experience of other regulatory environments to bear, though whether, as I was anonymously categorising The Guardian, I am an ultra-hawk on regulation, I leave it to others to determine. I should emphasise that what follows is my personal view on the issues at stake, and the panel's point of view has been explained in public in two documents, one green and one white. And I'm entirely behind the arguments put forward in those papers, as are all my former colleagues. Burns, unlike Beveridge, did not generate a minority report. But the way I'll describe the reasoning is my own, and I wouldn't wish to put words into my former colleagues' processes. The most difficult task faced by any reviewer of the BBC and its charter is that of selection. The BBC is so broad and so deep that no manageable report can hope to do full justice to all its activities. That, indeed, is one difficulty faced by its governors and executive management. We received submissions on a huge range of subjects and held seminars on many of them. And even though these issues were not all covered in detail in the published reports, I hope the airtime we gave to a range of different opinions will prove valuable in the longer run. And as with most of the previous committees of inquiry, if you look back at them, the eventual focus was in the areas of funding and regulation stroke governance. And obviously the two questions are intimately linked. The way in which the BBC is funded carries necessary implications for the accountability framework and therefore for the regulatory environment and the governance structure. And the reverse is also true. But for the purposes of exposition, I will begin with the funding. Now, the licence fee system has a long pedigree dating back to the foundation of the corporation. In his memoirs, Ian Trethewen, Director General from 77 to 82, summarised the position quite neatly. The theory of financing public service broadcasting by a poll tax imposed on each set was sensible and worked well. When the corporation was created in the early 20s, the fee was fixed at 10 shillings and it remained unchanged until 1946. John Reith was Director General for 14 years and never had to negotiate an increase in the licence fee. But inflation in the 60s and 70s and the ending of the natural buoyancy in revenue from the expansion of television sets themselves first and then secondly of colour sets create an environment where the increases in the fee needed to be regularly negotiated, which proved more difficult for politicians. And one interesting point about Trethewen's description of the licence fee written in 1984 is that he cheerfully and correctly describes it as a poll tax. That, of course, predated Mrs. Thatcher's interesting experiment with the community charge, which has somehow tarnished the term poll tax as a brand. I suspect you'd need to look hard to find the BBC describing their licence fee as a poll tax in their documentation today. But just as a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, there is no escaping the regressive implications of the licence fee. The Broadcasting Commission, so-called, under David Elstein, set up by the Conservative Party a couple of years ago, described the problems of the licence fee very clearly. Perhaps slightly mischievously, they quoted Jeff Mulgan, formerly the Prime Minister's head of strategy, and now, among other things, a visiting professor here, who described the licence fee as probably the most regressive tax in Britain today. The licence fee alone stands as an egalitarian flat rate charge linked in no way to ability to pay. Furthermore, it offends, he goes on, against the basic principle of consumerism in that it's paid regardless of your opinions on the relative worth of channels. It's a tax, he concludes, which has no democratic components, it lends no choices to those who pay, and conveys no information to the broadcaster. There are other disadvantages too, notably the heavy-handed nature of the enforcement regime, which criminalises non-payers, the evidence that poorer people in fact watch less BBC and typically cheaper programmes, even if they might watch more television in total, so there is a further double and indeed even triple element of perverse redistribution built into the system. And these arguments have been well set out by economists and others over many years. So indeed have the counter-arguments in favour. It keeps BBC funding largely out of the public expenditure process with its inevitable political dimension, promotes editorial independence, and generates a stronger relationship between the BBC and the population as a whole than would otherwise be the case. Furthermore, there's evidence that licence fee payers do not particularly resent the impost at its current level. The BBC produced research which suggests that most people regard it as reasonable value for money, and that indeed many would be prepared to pay more. Now, of course, the fact that there is a willing buyer and a willing seller doesn't necessarily mean that busybody economists or competition lawyers might not choose to intervene in the market to improve it. After all, individuals may be making their judgments based on imperfect information, and they've no means of knowing what kind of broadcasting might be generated if their funding was channeled in a different way. But undoubtedly, this lack of popular opposition to the licence fee produces a high hurdle over those over which those who would dismantle it must jump. These arguments are interesting, and good recent work has been done on the licence fee by Dieter Helm and others. Some of it was submitted to the panel. But many of the arguments are frankly ones which have been canvassed many times over in the last 79 years. Are there any new elements in the equation this time round which might cause us, unlike William Beveridge, Gavin Davis and Joyce Grenfell, to reach a different conclusion? Well, I see two new factors which might give us pause for thought. The first is the arrival of the digital age, and the second is the projected decline, which has been well described by Ofcom, in those other elements of public service broadcasting in the commercial world, which have hitherto provided some counterbalance to the BBC's dominant role. Now, it's important to be clear just why the arrival of digital television might affect the funding argument. In itself, a change in the technology of broadcasting carries no implication for the nature of it or the way it's funded. The BBC have attempted to illuminate the debate about this, but I'm not clear they've entirely succeeded. They commissioned a series of papers under the heading Funding Public Service Television in the Digital Age, which they published then with the misleading and somewhat provocative title, Can the Market Deliver? The papers are introduced by a foreword by Mark Thompson, the Director General, which adopts the time-honoured technique of setting up an Aunt Sally and knocking it down. Thompson says, some commentators argue that these technological advances mean that the age of public value in broadcasting is over. Well, I have searched diligently, but I have failed to identify any commentators who have argued that. What has been argued, which is obviously a more difficult point for the BBC, is that the pros and cons of the licence fee may be altered in circumstances in which it is possible to switch off an individual who's not prepared to pay. In those circumstances, is it reasonable to adopt an approach based on compulsion in the law? And if it's possible to switch off a non-payer and prevent her from seeing licence fee-funded output, in what respects does the system then in practice differ from a subscription service? In those circumstances, the arguments for and against a subscription basis for the BBC become rather different. So far, the subscription horse has refused at the fence of enforceability, in that free-to-air broadcasting cannot be denied to free riders. Now, the BBC clearly understands this point, even though Mark Thompson avoids it. We can say this with some confidence, because the thinking of the ancien régime has been set out for us very clearly by Greg Dyke in his memoirs Inside Story, published at the end of last year. And there, Greg Dyke explains the rationale for the BBC's introduction of Freeview. He says first that the reason was that it was important that the UK goes digital because that's the only way to ensure that all BBC services on radio and television are available to everyone. But his second reason is defensive and related explicitly to the licence fee. Once you've bought the Freeview box, you make no further payments, and the box is not programmed to allow for digital channels to be switched off. Indeed, as Dyke explains, I quote, Freeview makes it very hard for any government to make the BBC a paid television service. The more Freeview boxes out there, the harder it will be to switch the BBC to a subscription service, since most of the boxes can't be adapted for pay TV. I suspect Freeview will ensure the future of the licence fee for another decade at least, and probably longer. Freeview was, therefore, a cunning move on the part of the corporation, and it's now being appreciated as such by many commentators. Should this ploy, now made transparent, be allowed to succeed? Well, David Elstein's one who thinks it should not. Indeed, he argues that a relatively small amount of expenditure could adapt these boxes for subscription services. So where did the panel emerge from these arguments? The conclusions are summarised in the first of the two published papers entitled Emerging Themes. And there we said that the balance of the debate lies in favour of the licence fee for the time being. However, we are impressed with the arguments that suggest that it's becoming increasingly difficult to sustain the licence fee in the long term when conditional access is available. We therefore recommended that sometime during the next charter period there should be a detailed examination of the way in which conditional access might be developed to deal with circumstances where support for the licence fee is questioned. And I think the halfway point of the next charter would be a good moment for such a review. Now, it may be argued that this is an elegant exercise in constructing a fence on which to sit. However, in my view, it is a rational place to be at present. The public service broadcasting landscape is changing rapidly, as is the technology. And whatever we may think about the public policy merits of Greg Dyke's astute manoeuvre, we have to take the position as we find it. My hunch is that before the end of the eighth charter, there will have been a shift to a more mixed funding model, perhaps one of the options set out in the panel's paper. But I think it would be unwise to disrupt the licence fee arrangements now, in spite of their many disadvantages. This is not an intellectually elegant defence of the poll tax, but we'll have to do for now. We did, though, raise the related question of whether all the money raised by the license fee should necessarily go to the BBC. One may reasonably think that the license fee is a sensible means of funding public broadcasting, but that the BBC should not necessarily receive all of the £2.8 billion which the fee currently raises. It's always been possible to envisage that a proportion of the license fee should go elsewhere, but the argument has not been taken seriously in the past. Why might it be worth considering again now? Well, the reasons lie in an assessment of the likely evolution of public service broadcasting outside the BBC. In an era of spectrum scarcity, it was possible to devise funding mechanisms for the commercial sector which created and financed a public service obligation on independent companies. This was done in a rather different way for the ITV companies and the Channel 4, but the principle was the same. In a world of limitless digital spectrum, these arrangements are far more difficult to sustain. And Ofcom has, in its excellent review of public service broadcasting, which has served to inform the debate about the BBC charter, has calculated that a significant deficit, which it estimates at £400 million, will emerge as digital switchover arrives. So as the panel's interim report points out, it follows that if the BBC is not to be left to be a monopoly provider of such programming, a new economic model of funding must be available to incentivize commercial public service broadcasters. And an element of competition for license fee funds is one model that could ensure the continuation of competition for quality that has defined the UK broadcasting system to date. Now, Ofcom themselves have proposed other arrangements. Their report appears to reject the notion of top slicing the license fee, though the grounds for that rejection are not entirely clear. They consider some kind of license fee supplement might be appropriate. I find that a somewhat implausible prospect. If money is to be raised through a poll tax for public service broadcasting, I cannot see that two poll taxes are better than one. Indeed, the government rejected the Davis Committee's proposal for a separate digital license fee in 2000. The question of how large the license fee should be to fund a diversity of public service broadcasting is a different one. My own view, therefore, is there should be one license fee, but that we should look hard at whether it would be possible to find a mechanism for creating some element of contestability in that funding channel. New Zealand has set up a system along these lines, which is generating some useful experience of how it might work. A BBC-funded paper by Mayhew and Jones is somewhat negative about its transferability to the UK, though they do conclude that a contractual approach to the procurement and funding of specific, clearly defined areas of public service broadcasting could complement and strengthen the core UK institutional public service broadcasting system. There could well be an emerging role for such contestability in the future, albeit probably, as the author suggests, on the margins of the existing funding system. I wouldn't wish to go as far as Alan Peacock now recommends in his recent paper on public service broadcasting without the BBC. In an IEA publication which incorporates that piece, Carolyn Fairbairn, then of the BBC, well articulates the potential downsides of a full contestability model. But if an element of contestability is to emerge, as the panel says should be considered, then that immediately raises the question of how it should be managed and by whom. And those questions link neatly to the second area of focus in this charter review, which is the arrangements for the regulation and governance of the BBC in the future. And that was the subject on which the panel spent the greater part of its time. Now, the BBC's governance structure at the moment is peculiar. In his memoirs, Ian Tretham describes it as an extraordinary way to run the most renowned broadcasting organisation in the world. Greg Dyke is characteristically even blunter. The current system of governance should certainly be scrapped, he says. You cannot carry on running one of the biggest media systems in the world with a governance system more suited to a small charity. Indeed, to say that a major overhaul is required is now barely controversial. Gavin Davis has offered a defence of the role of the governors in a speech he made at the Said Business School in Oxford a few months after his resignation, but his successor, Michael Grade, has made no secret of the fact that he wishes to change both the composition of the governing body and its role and relationship with the BBC's management. He's already made some moves on both fronts, bringing in Anthony Saltz of Freshfields and broadcaster Richard Tate to strengthen the board, and introducing a whole series of additional structural changes under the general heading of building public value, and I'll come on to discuss those in a moment. Unfortunately, while there is almost unanimous agreement that the system should change, there is rather less agreement on how and why. To take the why first, some commentators focus on the governor's lack of knowledge of broadcasting as they see it and see that as the prime problem. Others focus on the political issues. Others outside the corporation think the problem is to find a way of preventing the BBC acting in a predatory way in relation to its competitors. Still others believe that the prime issue is how the corporation deals with complaints. Now, my view is that the essential problem is one of structure and accountability. I share Greg Dyke's view that the logic of the current system, whereby the governors are both regulators and also responsible for management, no longer holds water. While it may have worked over the years, it no longer stands up to intellectual analysis in a world more and more obsessed by accountability. Well, whether obsessed is the right word, I'm not sure. There was another chief executive working in the twilight world between the public and private sectors. I can see what he means. But I also think that the accountability issues are closely linked to the question of independence. The Hutton episode did show that lack of clarity about the governor's role made the BBC more vulnerable to political interference than it ought to be. Furthermore, this lack of clarity has led to other undesirable features of the relationship between the government and the corporation in recent years. The government has taken to serving up a series of one-person reviews of aspects of the BBC's business. Think of the Lambert Review of News 24, the Graff Review of the BBC's online services, the Gardam Review of Digital Radio, the Barwise Review of Digital TV. Now, while these reviews have in some cases produced useful recommendations, their very existence as a series of ad hoc examinations suggests that there is something wrong in the way in which the relationship between the government and the corporation is structured. It should not be necessary for the government regularly to interfere in this way in the BBC's business. And certainly, it should not be necessary if there were an effective regulator focusing on the public interest. Now, of course, I know that this government has a particular predilection for one-person reviews, and perhaps it's unrealistic to think that even if they set up a satisfactory watchdog, they would completely stop barking themselves. But the public policy aim should be to devise a system of accountability, regulation, and governance which pushes ad hocery to the margins and creates a stable framework based on rules and clarity of responsibility within which the corporation can move forward. I recognise that in this kind of language I'm beginning to sound rather like Gordon Brown, though perhaps without the conviction that comes with a Scottish accent. Now, this analysis is not far from that of the governors themselves under Michael Grade. In an important paper, very interesting paper last year, the BBC described its approach to assessing the public value of their output and also outlined a new approach to fulfilling the governor's traditional roles. It's fair to say that this approach remains under construction, so to speak, but the essential characteristics of it are that the governors are attempting to create a separation between governance and regulation, albeit within the existing legislative framework and without any formal alteration of the responsibilities they hold. Now, that evidently imposes some limitations on the degree of change which can be engineered. They're essentially talking about behavioural change rather than structural change. On this model, there will in future be a physical separation between the governors and the management. The governors have already moved across the road, as it were, into new premises. They're supported by a new governance unit separate from the management of the corporation itself. And the longer-term aim is that the relationship between the governors and the executive should be set within a framework of service licences. In other words, the BBC's management would set out the basis on which, say, Radio 1 would deliver public value in the future. The governors, after negotiation, would agree the terms of that service licence and monitor delivery against it in some way. But the responsibilities for month-to-month delivery would rest with the management, perhaps within a framework of targets incorporated into the licence. Now, I acknowledge that this is an artful construction. The governors have also shown the seriousness of their regulatory intent by commissioning a series of reviews of aspects of the BBC's operations. So, for example, they commissioned a paper on the BBC's European coverage to assess whether it was adequately balanced, giving due weight to the views of different constituencies in the European debate. But the question one needs to address is whether these behavioural changes within the existing structure will be adequate in the longer run. Will the system be sufficiently robust to persuade future governments not to interfere? Just as importantly, if they increase the emphasis on their regulatory role, do the governors create what we might call a corporate governance deficit at the heart of the corporation? In other words, if the governors move across the street, who is left to advise and counsel the Director General? and indeed to defend the corporation when it's under pressure. The normal role of non-executive directors of a company seems not to be performed by anyone under these new arrangements. There is no critical friend of the management if the governors are operating primarily as regulators at arm's length. In a typical corporate board, you certainly wouldn't see non-executives publishing reports critical of management performance, as is now envisaged. Now, my own view, and that of the Burns panel as a whole, is that it is not possible to resolve the contradictions that lie at the heart of the governor's responsibilities simply through behavioural change. And I share Greg Dyke's conclusion that there needs to be a separation of powers, with the BBC board made up of executives and knowledgeable non-executives responsible for running the BBC, and an outside regulator with the job of checking on it. So if the old arrangements are generally thought to be unsatisfactory, and if the building public value approach is not adequate to resolve the contradictions, what else might be done? Is there a third way? Now, broadly, one might imagine three third ways. The LSE is very fertile in this area. We could acknowledge that the obvious candidate to regulate the BBC is Ofcom. Or we could set up a new regulator for the BBC alone, what has been known in the jargon as Ofbeb. Or it may be possible to operate on the BBC's internal structure to create a more formal separation between regulation and governance, what the panel called in its interim report, Inbeb. A witty term, but which was not otherwise particularly helpful in describing what we meant. Now, the arguments for handing the job to Ofcom are powerful. Ofcom, in any event, has some responsibilities for the BBC. It has oversight of harm and offence, privacy and fair treatment, and responsibility for quotas on hours of news and current affairs programming, for regional programming, regional production, and indeed for competition. So unless the government wishes to legislate to remove all these responsibilities from Ofcom, which seems unlikely so soon after its establishment, it is bound to remain in some way part of the regulatory landscape. Furthermore, experience in other industries has suggested that regulators set up with a remit limited to one company can be quite difficult to manage. When Oftel faced up to BT alone, the relationships were very poor. The same was true of Ofgas and British Gas to an almost pathological degree. Experience in financial services and in communications generally has therefore led the government to create broad regulators able to step back from the circumstances of an individual company to see the interactions between different subsets of the industry and to regulate accordingly. Now, this is a powerful set of arguments, and I cannot help wondering whether, if the timing of Ofcom's establishment and charter review had come together more tidily, the government might not have extended the new regulator's remit from the start. But what are the arguments against the Ofcom solution? Greg Dyke argues that it would be unwise to extend Ofcom's coverage because it's essentially a regulator of the commercial sector and commercial interests would dominate in its decision making. Hard to know how much weight to attach to that argument. The proof of the pudding would clearly be in the eating. There is also a more general point made about the breadth of coverage of a communications regulator. Could Ofcom cope with the addition of the BBC? Well, as someone who has put together a regulator on an even larger scale, I do not attach great weight to these arguments. If you have more jobs to do, you have more people to do them. There is a need for a different type of management structure, perhaps, but the BBC certainly should be cautious about these arguments about extravagant scope and scale. Following that line of argument, it is quite easy to demonstrate that the BBC itself is constitutionally unmanageable. The most persuasive argument against the exclusive use of Ofcom is that the type of relationship which would be needed between the regulator and the BBC is of a different character from that which applies to Ofcom's relationship with commercial broadcasters. There are more complex judgments to be made on the nature of public service broadcasting and of what the BBC are now calling public value. There are different accountability relationships to Parliament which need to be considered, and there's the overriding importance of creating a stronger buffer between the government and the corporation. I'm not sure that Ofcom, with its broader role, could satisfactorily perform that buffer function. What we need is a new rather than an old buffer. Now, could that be created within the corporation itself, perhaps building on the Michael Grade proposals? And that, in essence, was the direction of thinking behind the panel's Inbeb option. When it was raised in a paper in early December, the Times and the Leader thought it was a rather good idea. The notion was that the governors would issue the service licenses, but there'd be a separate management board with non-executive directors, which would be responsible for meeting their requirements. So the final panel discussion on governance in early December spent some time on this INBEED option. We tried to determine just how accountability would operate within such a structure. How would the money flow? Who would be accountable to whom and for what? How would appointments be made to the twin boards which would coexist somehow within the corporation? These questions proved very difficult to answer. Michael Grade himself led an impressively rigorous forensic attack on the idea. He was clear in his view that to create two boards within the BBC structure would lead to hopeless confusion. It became clear that the problems of accountability and role definition which apply to the BBC's new model were equally, if indeed not more relevant, to INBEB, albeit in a slightly different way. So the panel's final report firmly recommended this hybrid model, and instead recommended the establishment of a public service broadcasting commission which would sit alongside the BBC board but outside the BBC structure. And indeed the solution is similar to that recommended by the Culture, Media and Sports Committee under Gerald Kaufman. Their report last December recommended one body for the accountability of the BBC and another which is in charge of the BBC, with the management body chosen through a professional appointment system rather than a system based on gender, ethnicity and other tokenism, in the committee's words. The governors, by contrast, should be appointed on the basis of relevant experience, particularly in the media, and charged with the specific role of regulating the BBC and maintaining its independence. In the Kaufman model, what the panel sees as a public service broadcasting commission is a reconstitution of the BBC's governance, but in other respects, what they recommend is more off-BEEB than in-BEEB, because it's clearly outside the corporation. Now, the detailed allocation of responsibilities between the PSBC and the BBC's Board of Management is set out in the paper attached to the Burns letter to Tessa Jowell at the end of January. Broadly, the PSBC would undertake the public interest oversight of public money and would recommend to the government the level of the licence fee. It would take on the current accountability role of the governors, combined with some of the responsibilities of government, and that's important to note, and would ensure that the charter objectives were met. It's very important to recognise that this model envisages that powers pass down from the government to the commission. The PSBC, unlike the government, the PSBC replacing the government in this respect, would give approval for new services and would be responsible for commissioning ex post reviews of those services. This would, we hope, severely restrict the government's ability to, and indeed desire to, interfere through ad hoc reviews. Ofcom would continue to be responsible for the regulation of competition and pan-broadcasting industry issues. With the PSBC in place, the BBC board could be reconstituted to meet the principles which have been carefully articulated after many iterations in the new combined code of corporate governance. While the BBC is, of course, a unique organisation, as its spokespeople never tire of telling us, in many respects, its governance needs are similar to those of major companies in the private sector. So a reconstituted BBC board would be responsible for providing leadership to the corporation, developing its strategy, and overseeing the appointment of senior executives. The board would be constituted very much on the lines of those of major corporations, with a non-executive chairman, a majority of independent non-executive directors, and with the Director General and a small number of other executives sitting as full members. And we've set out in the report proposals which would help to preserve the independence of that board and surround the appointments decisions with rigorous procedures to guard against political nominations. And there are other models in the regulatory sector, of which the arrangements for the Financial Services Authority are one, which incorporate such protections. I think it's important that the PSBC does not appoint the board. And indeed, in one respect, I believe that Ofcom's powers, whereby they appoint the chairman of Channel 4, are quite wrong. I think it is hopeless for a regulator to appoint people to bodies which it then regulates. You are hopelessly compromised if you have appointed the chairman. If I had been at the FSA responsible also for appointing the chairman of Barclays, I think I would have had no hope whatsoever in effectively monitoring Barclays' sales practices or capital. A division of responsibilities along these lines would clarify the accountability of the two bodies. The PSBC would be accountable to Parliament and the government for the delivery of the purposes set out in the Charter, while the BBC would be accountable for delivering against strategies and service licences. In that respect, the interesting new arrangements devised by Michael Grade already for service licences and the articulation of public value could be incorporated into this revised model. Responses to this proposal have been interesting, many of them positive. Ofcom noted that it was a model which was better equipped to adapt to future changes in funding and provision than the BBC's proposals. Greg Dyke said in The Independent that Lord Burns's proposals would not only create a BBC that is more politically independent and easier to run than it is today, but it would be better able to fight off the power and influence of Rupert Murdoch's Sky. Maybe the Times will be less supportive this time round. Nonetheless, one may anticipate some possible objections. Any proposal to create a new regulatory body must expect to be examined carefully and with some scepticism. Is there a risk that these arrangements could muddle accountability on the one hand and add unnecessary cost and bureaucracy on the other? Well, I've already made my view on the first point clear, and anyone who wishes to object to this proposed structure on the grounds of muddled accountability needs to deal first with the many criticisms of the existing arrangements on those grounds. The cost argument is not trivial. We are largely talking here about a redistribution of responsibilities between the government, Ofcom, the governors, and BBC management. The DCMS incurs costs today in service approvals and in financing serial one-man reviews. The BBC governors have armed themselves with staff support to perform their regulatory role, and the BBC itself is already gearing up to bid for the service licenses. So there is no a priori reason why the structure proposed by the panel should be any more costly, while it will certainly be more straightforward and transparent. According to Greg Dyke, the BBC are already spending several millions of pounds on new regulatory staff. I'm persuaded, in short, that the arrangements proposed in the Burns panel final report would have major advantages. They would buttress the BBC's independence. Nothing will stop governments trying to intervene in the affairs of a publicly owned broadcaster if it irritates them enough. If what we might call the Humphreys quotient rises too high, they will certainly complain. But we should make it as hard as possible for the government to circumvent the regulatory system. So, for example, if it's offended, the government should be required to complain to the BBC in the normal way. The PSBC should set out the basis on which the BBC would, in the first instance, handle complaints, and the regulator would provide an appeals mechanism for handling complaints that had not been adequately resolved by the corporation itself, which, again, the government should be required to use. Now, there's clearly one element of delicacy in these proposed new arrangements as to what happens to the existing personnel. It would seem from the way the role of the governors has been evolving over the last year that they are moving up to be the regulators under Michael Grade. In my view, he is moving in the wrong direction, and that he would be an outstanding head of the BBC as a media business rather than as a regulator, which should be left to some tedious former civil servant. Not, I have to say, that I'm bidding for the role. I've been there and done that. But before I conclude, I will just loop back briefly to the funding question. I explained earlier that there was a relationship between funding and regulation. In the longer run, the greater confidence that there is in the regulatory system that oversees the BBC, the more defensible the license fee will be. But if I'm right that over time, as the public service broadcasting landscape changes and the BBC's monopoly is willy-nilly reinforced, then we may need to think of a way of promoting some element of contestability in funding and of competition and provision for the reasons I explained earlier. The Public Service Broadcasting Commission, if constituted on the lines recommended by the panel, could oversee some element of contestability. If we think the licence fee will need to be reviewed at some point during the Eighth Charter, then it would be sensible to provide now for a mechanism which would allow for a development of alternative funding streams rather than be faced in 5 years' time with the difficulty of promoting new legislation. I think a solution along these lines would be the best guarantee of a continued strong and independent BBC, which was the main objective the panel had in mind. It's also the solution most likely to ensure continued popular and political support for a licence fee. The BBC would not itself have to be the principal advocate of the licence fee, which is always awkward for it. The PSBC would take on that role. In introducing his committee's report, Gerald Kaufman argued that we should move away from periodic charter renewal and towards a regulatory and governance structure which will be more durable and which provides mechanisms to deal with issues which emerge in relation to the BBC as the technology and the competitive environment change. Well, the panel was not invited to address the question of the charter renewal process itself and didn't do so. For my part, I think there is a strong case for trying to move away from 10-year reviews for precisely the reason which one governor has advanced, that it imposes a kind of planning blight over the corporation for 30% of its life. Sadly, for the BBC, the current charter review still has some way to go. The government have promised a green paper as the next stage, and I understand that it's imminent. I will be disappointed if the panel's suggestions on funding and governance are not presented as one option on which they will consult in a green paper process. The latest Ofcom paper recommends that approach. So I hope we will see further debate on the pros and cons of a public service broadcasting commission in the next few months. The government is, I guess, unlikely to wish to bring the process to a conclusion this side of the general election, but I'm sure the BBC is very much hoping for clarity about the future to emerge before the end of this year. They can then get on with their core businesses of making entertaining programmes, promoting culture, educating the population, informing our democratic processes, and responding to outraged complaints from the Number 10 Press Office.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to thank very much Howard for that inside story and very articulately put, as one now knows to expect. We now have about 20 minutes, 25 minutes for questions. We have to finish at 7:45. Those of you who want to ask questions, please put your hands up and I invite you to identify yourself first. I'm going to ask the first question, however, and I want to ask Howard what you think about the likely government response to the Burns recommendations.
Well, the smoke appearing from the DCMS has suggested that the government understands the funding issue in the long run, but is not disposed to address it in the short run, and indeed for reasons which I support. So I guess I would expect that on the funding, I think the government will have a green paper which points towards continuation of the licence fee, and I think the question there probably surrounds whether there is a formal commitment to a review in X year's time, or whether there are words which say we'll need to look at it. And I imagine that that's where the debate will lie. I'd be surprised if on the funding options the debate was very much broader than that, given the weight of public opinion that has been expressed on the licence fee. The governance is much more difficult because there are more different options to consider, and undoubtedly the relationship between the government, Ofcom, both of which are bound to remain in the picture one way or the other, and then the BBC governance, which is going to remain in the picture, and whether somebody should be inserted into that equation is, I think, the territory which they're going to have to think hardest about. And I find it difficult to know how that will come out. I think the government would be making a mistake if they didn't consult on a range of options, because I think there is a considerable weight of opinion, including some people who have worked for years within the system, which believes that the current system does not work and is not reformable without some considerable structural change. So I think if the government were to close off the option of structural change now, that would be a great mistake. And indeed, if they did that, I think that they would be creating an awkward situation for the BBC, because I think the last thing the BBC should want is to begin the next charter with a system of governance and accountability which is still heavily criticised. I think they should want to believe to begin the next process with something which people feel is adequately reflecting the public interest. So I hope that that's where the government gets to.
Thank you very much. There's a question right at the end. Please announce yourself and speak clearly.
Hi, Stefan Magdalinsky. I'm a licence payer.
As are we all.
Yeah. You talked a lot about that you considered in terms of what should happen with the charter, the impact of digital broadcast and Freeview and that kind of technology. Did you spend any time thinking about what happens when people are downloading large numbers of programs via the internet and essentially an on-demand environment? And what impact do you think that would have on the charter over the next 10 years?
Yes. Well, we did that. We did that to some degree. And Ofcom have done so in their consultations on the future of public service broadcasting. If you maintain a license fee system, then in a sense it matters a lot less how people then consume what you produce, because it's funded through a poll tax And if they choose to watch it through their own personal digital recorder or at the middle of the night or whatever, then it really doesn't make very much difference because the funding stream is indifferent to that. Where that applies most is, of course, in the ability of other broadcasters not funded by the license fee to capture any income related to programs where you can then screen out the advertising and everything else. And so that kind of thinking comes into the Ofcom analysis, which suggests that there will be a public service television deficit outside the license fee. And I think it, therefore, to my mind, carries two implications. One, I think if you believe in public service broadcasting at all, as I certainly do, then it strengthens the case for some license fee funding. On the other hand, it also strengthens the case for some element of contestability in the use of that license fee funding, because there won't be other sources of funding for public service broadcasting.
Thank you. Gentlemen at the
front. Calum Chase from KPMG. I think your conclusion that you have to separate the regulation from the supervision of the management of the BBC is uncontestable, and it'd be astonishing if the government didn't take that on board. I think a lot of people are more surprised about your conclusion that Ofcom shouldn't get the regulator's job. And your argument for that seems to be that they have to have a different approach to the BBC than they do to the commercial broadcasters. Surely that's also true of BT. They have to take a very different approach to BT than they do, say, to Kingston and other telecoms operators. There's surely some very strong arguments for having Ofcom do regulation across the whole of the broadcasting ecology. And I'm surprised that didn't persuade you the other direction.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised at that too, because I confess that that's kind of where I started in this review. But I think I was persuaded that it would be a different kind of relationship. And the PSBC would be would be recommending the level of the license fee. And it would have to do that, obviously, based on an assessment of the quality of what the corporation was doing and an assessment of the public acceptability of it, etc. So it would be exerting a very significant influence over the total funding environment of the BBC, which it regulated. That seems to me to be quite a different relationship from the relationship which Ofcom has with most of its creatures, where it has some impact, but not now. I mean, the old Oftel was more in that kind of relationship because its charging structure for the areas which were regulated in terms of cost and charging was having a direct influence. But nowadays, in that much more competitive market, Ofcom is not determining the income of the creatures it regulates. Also, the PSBC would be engaged in a much more intense and close debate about the content, because it would be on the commissioning side, if you like, of these service licenses, which is as envisaged in the BBC's own proposals. And that, again, would, I think, bring it much closer to the corporation than Ofcom typically is to its clients. So I, for those reasons, believe that it would be of a very different character of relationship. And then when I reflected back on my own experience as a regulator, I think that it would have been quite difficult to manage the FSA if one large chunk of the FSA had actually been funding part of the industry, if you like, and responsible for its whole sort of viability and determining its financial structure. Whereas the rest of the organization was stepping back saying, look, these are the rules of the game within which you must play, and if you don't play them, we will discipline you for not doing, but not engaged in that kind of closeness about of designing its products, if you like. You know, I always resisted at the FSA the notion the FSA should be responsible in any way for designing products. And effectively, that, you know, the analogy would be that Ofcom would be closer to that. So for part of the market, it would be this close, and for the rest of the market, it would be up here. And I think that would actually be quite difficult. I don't really buy Greg Dyke's arguments on this, that it would be naturally biased to favour the commercial companies. I think probably the reverse would be true, because it would be closer to the BBC than to the others. It would probably be more likely to bias them. But I just think the character of the relationship, for the reasons I've described, would be quite different. And therefore, I think there's a respectable argument for having a separate regulator, albeit the relationships between it would have to be rather carefully articulated. And I think that argument for separation is additionally strong if you are making it potentially the funder as a result of making the license fee somewhat contestable, which I think would also create a somewhat different relationship. So in the end, you know, after beginning in the place from which your question comes, I was persuaded that the balance of argument lay in the other direction. I won't say that it's an open and shut case, but I think the balance of the argument, to me, is just about in favour of a separate regulator.
Thank you. There's a lady here.
Hello, I'm Donatella Bernstein. I'm not a license payer. I've given up TV last year because there wasn't much I wanted to watch. I thank you very much for summing up the issues so clearly. I'd like to raise a question of perspective. If we're talking about the hows, how to run it, what regulation, the mechanics of the corporation, but I would like to raise a question. If we start from the why have public service broadcasting, then perhaps we can find a way to ensure that it's a quality product for the betterment of society, for the information for all. Because at the moment, it's really difficult to get quality information on what's going on in the world, and it's getting worse and worse. I would question that the centralization, for example, of the news services in the BBC is making for less variety. We're getting then the same kind of information on all the channels. It's still very good compared to other broadcasting organizations. And I'm very proud of the BBC. It's one of the perks of living in this country, still very, very good. But the quality shifted to the World Service and to radio. TV is absolutely appalling. And for public service broadcasting, if you're paying money, it's because you want to ensure the independence and the quality. It's not there to turn us into zombies. Now, one example would be, for example, even quality documentaries like Horizon using docudrama. And I inquired about this, why are we getting this kind of PAP? Unnecessary for a documentary, should be a documentary, not some kind of psychodrama. And apparently they can't sell to Americans if they don't produce programs like that. Now, documentaries are a strong point of the BBC. We shouldn't worry about the Americans. We're paying it for it ourselves, and we want better quality.
Can I ask you just ask the question?
The question is, if you start from the big issues, like what is the BBC for and why are we paying a license fee, then maybe we can find some way of regulating it so it's accountable to the public, and not just one sector of the public and the commercialization of it.
Thank you.
We did do that, actually. And we did talk in the papers about what the BBC is for. And we articulated some general definition of what we saw as the value of public service broadcasting. And I think it would be very close to what you were saying. And it was really from that that we then came to the points which I highlighted tonight, because they were the points of controversy about the funding and the accountability. But my suggestion to you is that the model that we have set out is one which ought to work towards a clearer and indeed purer delivery of public service broadcasting by the BBC than the current one. I mean, this is not something which we put in our report, but my own view on it is as follows. That at the moment, because the BBC itself has to articulate the case for the license fee and defend it,
the BBC, and the BBC is not in a terribly good position to do that in a funny way, because people will say, well, of course you defend the license because your own money, isn't it? It's lining your pockets, you know, etc. So they are in the, you would say that, wouldn't you, kind of corner. And therefore, the BBC is, I think, impelled to be more concerned about popularity and reach and share than perhaps in a perfect world it needs to be, because it feels that in order to defend its license fee, it must be saying, well, we're doing this, this, and this, and we're getting everybody, we're doing something for everybody. If, in fact, you have a Public Service Broadcasting Commission, which is separate from the BBC, not benefiting directly from the license fee, and able to articulate a definition of public service broadcasting within which the BBC would operate, I think the BBC would have to do less of this chasing after share in areas which are frankly right at the margins of what one might justify as public service broadcasting, which I think is what currently happens to some degree. And therefore, you would be more likely under this system to have the sort of public service broadcasting that you want. I would say just one other thing, and honestly, I can't say that I could be competent to rule on whether the centralisation of news and current affairs production is delivering any more homogeneous or less good news. I would find that very difficult to determine. But I do think that the BBC's news services have been kept up to the mark by the existence of a decently funded independent competitor, and that our system would provide the possibility that that should be maintained in the future. And if you don't have any element of contestability and license fee funding, I think the risk is that there will not be any competitor for the BBC's news and current affairs output in the future, except Sky.
Thank you very much. A question here. Could it be reasonably succinct? Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Michael Place, and I would like to ask why you have this apparently very clear support for the license fee, when, to my mind, it must be the worst, most inequitable tax ever actually invented. You refer to it as a poll tax, but in fact it's two or three times worse than a poll tax, because a poll tax is per head, the license fee is per household, and of course that means that households of four or five people are only paying one fee, whereas the unmarried mother or the single person is also paying one fee, and it's grossly disproportionate and a great burden on the less well-off. Once you're above a certain level, of course, it doesn't matter. And I'm sure all the people who spoke to the committee were not really affected by the license fee one way or the other. Also a source of great harassment. TV licensing claim that they actually approach 400,000 people a year who they claim have not paid their license fee, and then prosecute nearly 100,000 of these, of whom about 80,000 are apparently found to be committed, found guilty. This seems to me a wholly inappropriate tax to have on the people of this country, and I'd like to know why the committee really supported it, or whether they went into that sort of detail.
Well, I thought I'd set out pretty clearly what the disadvantages of the license fee were, which you've re-articulated forcibly. I think that the problem that opponents of the license fee have to deal with is to say, first of all, do you want public service broadcasting at all? If you get over that hurdle and say you do, if you don't want that, then that's fine. Even though you haven't got a problem, you don't need a license fee. If you believe that there is some value in terms of the broadcasting ecology of this country and some educational value and cultural value in public service broadcasting, which I would think there is, then you have to get over the hurdle of how you finance it. And all the various alternative methods of financing it have all kinds of difficulties with them. Some of them, if they're focused, done through purely through taxation, are difficult from the point of view of the independence of the broadcaster, and others are just very difficult to collect. And if you then say, well, what is the evidence that the people are with you in your opposition to the license fee? The evidence is not so great. That the BBC's own surveys, and I guess you might say, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? But I believe that they've done this with some integrity, show that, in fact, a great majority of people in this country think it's pretty good value for money. And therefore, as I said in my paper, you know, there's got to be, you've got a quite a high hurdle to jump, even if you do believe, and I think you well articulate the problems of regressive taxation, and it is an extraordinary impost, really. But you do have to get over the problem, one, that there isn't an alternative, and two, that most people quite like it.
David Levy from the BBC.
Thank you very much for a really kind of wide-ranging lecture. In the new sort of separated structures of the BBC, I work for management, so I'm not going to ask you anything about governance. I wanted to ask you something about how successful you think the BBC is actually as a public service institution in terms of delivering. And in terms of your own, I mean, you had 13 seminars, you looked at the whole range of BBC's purposes, you've got a lot of experience of other public sector institutions. Do you think the BBC is broadly better or worse than the average in terms of delivering as a public sector institution? And how do you think it stacks up against other public service broadcasters around the world? Is it sort of in the middle, worse or better? That's a question. And just one observation on subscription and funding. I think I thought your discussion of subscription was very interesting, but I think there is really a difference between the ability to charge people on an individual fee basis for subscription and the desirability of doing it. And I think you could very easily come to a point where you might say you are able to do this, but you may still decide whether or not it's desirable to do it. And as far as Freeview is concerned, I know what Greg Dyke's book says, but if you go into Dixon's, you can buy a Freeview box today with a conditional access slot, which will allow you to plug in a card that would allow you to get top-up TV, a pay service. So subscription is no doubt going to become something that's perfectly possible, but there's a separate question about its desirability.
Yeah, I think David Ilstein personally goes around fitting in those little slots in the Dixon's ones. The first question sort of divided into two. I'm not sure I'm wholly competent to answer the second part of it, which is to how it compares with other public service broadcasters internationally, though I think the conventional wisdom is that it compares very well, but I wouldn't like to. I mean, certainly the World Service clearly does. The listening figures evidently show that where you're in a direct competition, the BBC does extremely well. I think that comparing the BBC with other public sector organisations is quite tricky because there's an apples and pears dimension about it. What I would say is that I think the BBC is pretty good at communication. I think it gets unjustifiably criticised for that. I think actually the BBC is quite good at communicating what it does, and I think now the BBC is achieving fairly high standards of transparency. I'm not sure that was always the case, but transparency in terms of, you know, how it spends its money and how its decisions are made. I think it scores reasonably well on that. I would observe that the pathology of the corporation seems to make it perhaps more sensitive to criticism than I would think it might sometimes be, might need to be, actually. And sometimes the kind of immediate responses to criticisms tend to be rather unthinking on occasion. And also, I think there's a, if they're not with us, they're against us kind of mood in the corporation, I still feel. I mean, sometimes I think we felt at the Burns panel that because we were just set up as a panel, you know, that we were bound to be hostile. BBC seemed to assume that we were going to be against the license fee. I mean, you know, the arguments that put to us were sort of as if it was more or less bound to be that was where we were. So I believe there's a kind of an odd pathology in the BBC. But I think otherwise, it's I would say it was a rather successful public sector organisation, and one which seems to me to have a reasonable understanding of the importance of cost control. On your last point, on the desirability or otherwise, yes, I agree that there are two separate questions, but my argument would be that if you think Ofcom are right about the difficulty of getting any kind of surplus, if you like, that you can protect in future to fund public service broadcasting outside the BBC, and if you believe that the BBC benefits and the whole public service broadcasting environment benefits from there being some degree of competition, then you start to be driven to a position where it looks as though contestable funding would be a good idea. And then you might say, well, if you do that, then should you just recognize that the BBC is going to get smaller? Well, I don't see why you should necessarily recognize it should get smaller if the BBC can produce output for which people are prepared to pay. So my own model would be, in 5 years' time, prejudging the review we recommend, would be to end up with a license fee, which would be quite large, because I would think there's quite a lot of the BBC that it will be difficult not to charge license fee for. That includes pretty much the whole of radio, it includes news and current affairs, it includes a lot of the cultural output. But that on top of that, the BBC should be able to charge and offer subscription services using its archive, but using work for more entertainment programmes, which it would be charging for in competition. I personally think that would probably end up with a larger BBC than there is now, but some of it funded through subscription services and some of the licence fee funding the public service broadcasting competition that I believe we need for a healthy system. So that would be where I would end up.
We've got two people who have been queuing up. I'm going to ask them quickly to ask quick questions together and then for Howard to use that as an opportunity to come to conclusions. There's a gentleman here and the gentleman there. Could you try and make it?
Thank you. My name is Matthew Postgate. I also work for the BBC. I just wondered whether or not you could say a few words about how you think the concept of a PSBC would relate to Ofcom's other great experiment at the moment of a public service publisher. Are they the same thing? Could they coexist? Is it Ofcom trying to make a sort of similar play for some kind of commissioning role? Just how they would work, if they should work together at all.
Can we just take that one here, and then perhaps you can...
Hello, my name is Simon Terrington. I run a firm called Human Capital, which wrote a chapter of the Red Book, and I was also seconded to the governors for a while, so perhaps I'm a bit of a defender of the status quo. I should just warn that up front. I think that was a beautiful exposition of the issues, and I think probably the clearest and the best reasoned exposition of the issues and the possible solutions, and it's moved me a hell of a long way, and as I say, I'm kind of bought into the original system. There was one thing I wanted to challenge on right at the end, which is the idea that the PSBC should have contestable funding and should give funds to other organisations. I have three concerns with it, and I'm sure you've thought about them, but I'd just like to hear you talk about them a bit. And three concerns are two things on accountability. The first thing is, if as it might be, Channel 4 promised to make a programme and it doesn't turn out the way the PSBC wanted it, you know, are they going to get unhappy about that? How is Channel 4 accountable to them? The second thing is about the population as a whole, because right now people pay the licence fee for the whole BBC, and you can sort of understand that, even though some people don't realise it pays for radio, you sort of get that. If the PSBC is allocating it into all sorts of parts of other broadcasters' schedules, I worry that the population won't sort of be able to kind of comprehend that. Actually, I've forgotten the third point, so
good.
Maybe just the two. Thank you.
We're running out of time.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I ask Howard to respond?
Well, those two questions run very neatly together, quite by chance, I think. But I think that I'm not. I think it would strong. It would significantly weaken the case for a public service for a PSP, for the Ofcom PSP, actually. And as I said in my speech, I don't really think that the idea of a sort of second license fee on top to fund this PSP would really make a lot of sense. I think if you went for a PSBC, that would be it, to my mind. I think that would replace it. As for your points, the third one I very much agree with. The other two, how should I put this? I think that I was not recommending that we move straight to a contestable funding model. And I think that one reason for that, which I didn't say, but which is relevant to your question, I think, is that I believe this technology, if you like, of describing and measuring public value, which is a heroic endeavor on which the BBC are currently engaged, I think is very promising, but I think it has some way to run. But if the BBC are right that it's possible to do that, and they have set out, after all, a fairly clear explanation of how you would and the different components of public value and how you'd measure it, then I think that if that's right, if the BBC are right, then you will, after two or three years, you will have the basis for setting out what you want in terms of other people's bidding for it. In other words, people will have a clear framework within which they can bid and offer. Now, of course, they will make good programs and lousy programs, but the BBC does that too, not necessarily deliberately, but clearly they do. So that doesn't mean that they'll all be good, but that they will have a framework within which they will have to meet, and that framework will be much better articulated than in the past. So that's why I think in due course the PSBC might be in a position to go in for and manage a contestable funding framework in a way that would be now difficult to do. Your second point is a very interesting one, which I hadn't thought about, and one would actually have to think of a way of, you know, sort of branding these, if you like, as things for which you were paying in your license fee. I can't believe that's completely impossible to do, but I think it's an interesting point which I hadn't thought of, and I shall reflect on it.
Very good. Well, we always reflect on things at the LSE ad infinitum, and I'd like to thank Howard Davis very much for a wonderful lecture, and thank you for your questions. Thank you. Very good. Very, very good.